For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Very happy to have giving a talk this evening, Matt Vogel, who's our new head Dawan, recently. Thank you very much, Matt, for giving the talk tonight. Oh.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And thanks to everyone for coming out tonight for this beautiful night with this beautiful weather, you know. So the title of my talk, I'm still maybe workshopping it a little bit here, but it's Teaching in Zazen, Sitting in the Fire, Watching Clouds with Monsters. So I'm a teacher, and I'll go into that later. But first of all, I want to start with this story. And it's Chao Chu, right? And Nanguan? Chao Chu?
Chao Chu.
Chao Chu, okay. I get the pronunciation mixed up. So, yeah. Chao Chu asks Nanguan, his teacher, what is the way? And Nanguan answers, ordinary mind is the way, or everyday mind is the way. And Chao Chu says, well, how can I reach it? And Nanguan says, well, the more you try to approach it, the further away it gets. And he's a very good student. He keeps asking questions, right? Then how do you know if it's the way? And the Nanguan answers, it's not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is indifference. When you reach the true way beyond doubt, it's as vast and open as the sky. How could it be a matter of affirming or negating it? I want to focus on the first two questions of this and his answer. Everyday mind is the way, and the more you try to approach it, the further away it gets. And I'm going to do this with a story and a poem. So first of all, the context of where I work. I'm a fourth grade teacher in a suburban school, public school. If you walk into my classroom, you might actually miss me. I'm one of those teachers who gives the students the work to do, and they go off and do it, and then I'm working with them. So you might not actually see me at first. It's not the traditional standing in front of the class, although I do that sometimes too. It's a really active and energetic place. And so I play a lot of different roles. Sometimes I'm a coach. Sometimes I'm a facilitator. Sometimes I'm a cheerleader. You know, there's a lot of different roles that you play depending on who's in front of you at the moment. We do a lot of project-based learning, which means that we do all the traditional reading and writing kind of instruction, but we try to do it with a purpose, and usually with a purpose that the students are directing. For example, one time we noticed that after Malala won the Nobel Peace Prize, there were no really good websites about Nobel Peace Prize winners for third, fourth, and fifth graders. So we made a website where they researched Peace Prize winners, like Malala was one, the Dalai Lama, Doctors Without Borders, and then they made a web page about them and a little short video to introduce it to kids who were their age. This past year, a whole team of fifth grade teachers invited in kids with lots of serious conditions, I'll say, like severe autism or cerebral palsy, and they came in and we had one or two of them, and we did activities with them. We had one, for some of them, we went bowling, we did went to Pump It Up, things like that, to get to know them, and then we made documentaries about these kids and then had a film festival. And so like about 500 people came with all the parents and everyone, and it was really great because these kids are usually marginalized and off to the side, and they were the star of the show. So these are the kind of things we do in addition to the regular things. So, and then we also have those students that we need extra care and special attention. And I'm going to kind of focus on one of them who really taught me that ordinary mind is the way, and the more you try to approach it, the further away it gets. We'll call him Eddie. He everything he did was to try to somehow get attention from you or from the class. He tried to derail everything that you tried to do. A lot of it was because he couldn't read very well, and he couldn't write, and he just had a really poor impulse control. He suffered from abuse as a young child. He had just a lot going on. And so we had to deal with or figure out a way to work with this student. For example, when we have these kind of students, we take data on them. And so it's like you, in one lesson of about 10, one part of a lesson, 10 minutes, I checked off that he either touched, grabbed, or touched someone else's things 25 times in about 10 minutes. And so, you know, he's like always, you know, like all over the place, you know. And in 3 minutes, he shouted out, not always, sometimes inappropriate things, but not always inappropriate things, but just like shouting out in a three minute time period about 25 times. So he just like has a lot going on. And so you can imagine when you have him in your classroom, it's sort of like there's this ripple effect that goes out to everyone. And it's very frustrating and very annoying, anxiety provoking, because like if I focus so much on him, what about the rest of the class? What are they going to do? You know, so it was a real test for me. And so I just finished this up, but I've been teaching summer school to kids who need review and reinforcement for reading, and we were reading this story, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly like being a teacher in that situation. And it's actually a lot like Zazen, too. So I'll just tell it really quickly. It says, I'll give you the short version. So this is from a Native American tribe in from the Northeast, so Eastern Maine and Canada. So there's a girl and her three brothers, and they go out into a hunting party where they hunt to bring, you know, like, back food and skins for their families. And so the three brothers are these great hunters. They're very brave, and they go out and they come back telling all these great stories about how brave they were and how smart they are. And she's the youngest, and so her job is to sort of take care of the camp, to take care of her brothers when they come back, to take care, make sure they have food to eat besides the meat, you know, the berries and all the other things too, to make sure the campfire is going, those kind of things. And they call her Little Listener, which I really like that name, Little Listener, because she loves to hear their stories, and she's very quiet, and she just takes care of what she needs to take care of. One day the three brothers come back, and they're like pale and afraid, and they're like, what's going on? And the one brother says, I saw these giant footsteps coming toward our camp from the north. And the other brother said, I saw that coming from the west. And the other brother said, from the south, I saw the same things. And so they're all terrified, and they try to talk themselves out of it. Oh, it's just a big bear. What Little Listener didn't say was that she had seen those coming from the east. And she didn't say anything because she knew that these footprints came from this huge cannibalistic monster that if you say its name, it will come into your camp and eat you. Scary stuff. And so the next day, the brothers go off hunting. They're fine. She decides to do something a little different. She cooks this huge pot of stew and is cooking it. And she sets up this really nice place just to the left of the door. And then, of course, you know what happens, right? She hears this rumbling, these huge footsteps shaking the lodge. And suddenly in pops in this huge monster. It can barely fit into the door of the lodge. And right when it comes in, she says, Grandfather, how about some stew? And so the monster is very taken aback and says, okay, granddaughter. I didn't know I had a granddaughter, but okay. And so he takes it. And for him, this huge pot of stew is just like a little cup, downs it, you know. And then she says, Grandfather, why don't you have a seat? I made you a nice place here. So he sits down, and he says, usually I would have eaten you by now. And he has these huge teeth that are like the size of spears, a necklace made out of human skulls. probably really bad breath too, if that wasn't part of the story. But and so he says, but you have treated me with kindness. So anyone who lives in this lodge, I'll spare their lives. And she said, you know, you're looking kind of tired too. Why don't you take a little nap on that at that spot there? So he's like, you know what? I really am tired. So thank you for your kindness. And so he takes a little nap. And then she goes outside and waits for her brothers to return. So her brothers come back, and they have a deer and all these animals with them. And she has kind of a smile on her face. And they're like, so what did you do today, little listener? And she's like, oh, nothing. I just welcomed grandfather back. And they're like, grandfather? Wow. And she said, you have to promise to call him grandfather when he comes out. And they're like, okay, whatever. And then the monster's name is the Chenu. Sorry, I forgot to say that. The Chenu sticks his head out, and they're like, whoa, you know, like, you know, so surprised and scared. And little listener's like, brothers, why don't you greet our grandfather? And they're like, grandfather, so nice to see you. And he says, oh, good, you brought some food. And so he grabs the deer and eats it in one gulp, and grabs the birds and eats it in another gulp. And so he's, thank you, grandsons. And then little listener says, you know what, that was our dinner, grandfather. Why don't you go out? Can you get us some food now that we're, you know, now that you've eaten our food? It's like, well, of course. And then he goes off and brings them back food. And as it, you know, they live with this their grandfather, and he hunts for them, and they have this amazing amount of food now, more than they could ever have caught on their own to bring back to their village. But one day they have to go back to their village, and the grandfather says, the Chenu says, I can't go back with you. People will think I'm a monster. So what I'd like you to do is build me a sweat lodge. So they say, okay. So they build this gigantic sweat lodge because he's huge. And they start bringing in rocks, and it's super hot. They can't stand it, but he's like, it needs to be hotter. And they bring in more, and the rocks are as tall as a tall man, you know. And he said, more. And then finally, he's quiet, and they just sit and wait. And then a little listener asks, grandfather, are you okay? And then out of the sweat lodge comes the voice of a kind of a weak voice of an older man, and says, yes, granddaughter, thank you. And he came up, and then he comes out and he spits out a piece of ice shaped like a person. And he says, throw that in the fire. And the brothers are, again, too scared to do anything about it. She grabs it, throws it in the fire. And he says, thank you so much. I was, you know, I was caught in the spirit of this Chenu. I've had to, you know, live my life of roaming and eating people and animals, and so thank you so much. And then they took him back to the village, and as far as we know, they're still all happily living there. So one thing that I really liked about this story was the way that little listener related to this gigantic monster that is threatening, was going to eat her. She sat quietly and waited for him to come. And then when he came, she treated him with respect and kindness. She didn't try to run away. She didn't try to fight it. Those probably would have been useless anyway in this case. And instead, she just sat and respected it kindly. She gave it what the monster needed at that moment. And it reminded me of this... Well, I was reading this. It was really strange. And when we were doing the practice commitment period, we read the Lotus Sutra, and there was a quote that kept coming back to me from the lifetime of the Tathagata. And it says, my pure land will never be destroyed, yet the multitude see it as being consumed in fire, everywhere filled with grief and fear and all kinds of suffering. But those who do good, who are gentle and honest, will see me here teaching the Dharma. So I had this vision in my mind of like, or visualizing this picture of like all this like suffering everywhere, just like in flames, and then a Buddha sitting there, like on the, like that, like sitting there. And then I started to think, well, maybe the Buddha isn't just sitting. Maybe she's making deliveries for a food pantry, you know? Who knows? Maybe she's in a singing group, you know? I don't know. There's like lots of ways to be Buddha. So I thought, this is a really interesting way of thinking, like, of the Buddha's work is sitting, because before this, the Buddha's talking about how magical his, you know, his Pure Land is, and it's like over the top descriptions, and it's like, well, we see it as burning with fear and despair and suffering. And I think I also like this description because for me, personally, like the way I feel a lot of strong emotions is like a burning sensation in my body. How does this all relate to like working with kids and everything? Well, I kind of was like, Eddie was a lot like this monster that just came into my space, you know? And I had to figure out a way to deal with him. I couldn't fight him. There was no use in fighting those kids. They want a power struggle, right? They want to go. So how do you respond to him in a way that is positive, that respects him as a person, and really just like makes it so that you can work together on something? And so first of all, I guess the first thing I did was come back to Zazen practice and just take a breath or come back to my body. I'd notice sometimes I'd be like sitting there like, and then just like, I just needed to sit up, you know, and like, oh, okay, that's already better, you know, or take a breath. And it didn't change anything about what he was doing. It wasn't like, oh, I'm sitting up. Well, now he has changed, you know, like everything is better, you know. It was, you know, like, but just that like couple of seconds, sometimes it was even just 1 second of just like checking in with my body, and it made it just like instantly my ability to respond to the situation in a compassionate way just was exponential. I don't even understand how that works, to be honest. My first thing that I learned to do was like just respond by coming back to my body. And I think that's a little bit of taking care of myself first before I can respond to him. And then also realizing that treating him so that he's not a monster, he's not a problem. A lot of teachers would think of him, and some I understand why, that this is like a big problem that we have. So work, and this wasn't just me, I had a team of people that were helping me work with him, is he's a puzzle that we need to figure out. Like, that just changes a little bit. Like, we still need to work with this guy, but he's a puzzle that we have to figure out. So he had a schedule that started with some extra gym time in the morning. He carried some weights around because that really helps kids like that. Like, they need to feel that grounded feeling. Having frequent breaks throughout the lesson he would give me a signal and he could go back to the back table and like play with this like this stuff called putty that we call it. It's like this like kind of like Play-Doh kind of stuff, just to like get a little sensory break. He had every 30 minutes he would get a break where he could go out and walk. When he really loved discussion, was really good at discussing things, and so he was for sure there for that part of the lesson. But maybe when we were doing regular reading instruction, he would have to go out and get reading instruction from a special ed teacher. So just like figuring out a way to structure his life so that he could be a learner, so he could be a student. And I'm not going to say like somehow he transformed like the Chenu did at the end, but I really saw how he was able to be more present with us, and he was able to learn. I think we formed a really close bond, the two of us, because we went through a lot together. And I think another thing I learned from this too is that to have trust and confidence. In that moment when I was talking about coming back to my body and responding, to actually trust that response, because I think that was maybe one of my monsters, is like not feeling very secure about what I'm going to do. And so just going with it and realizing that I could just go with it and then go with the next one and then go with the next one. As long as I kept that sort of like coming back, that I could trust that. It's like trusting myself and trusting Zazen and trusting Eddie, you know, like we had, it became like this very fluid kind of feeling. And I think like it also reminded me of a quote, I think that Taigen said, like about how all beings come and express themselves, and thinking about how is Eddie expressing himself right now? Is the rest of the class expressing themselves? And just be able to relate to them with kindness and compassion. That you know, and I have not mastered all of this yet, but it really, like, it was like this student really taught me more, I think, more than I taught him, you know, one of those situations. So that's kind of like a little listener sitting in her tent, you know, waiting for this monster to come, waiting for maybe to die, you know, but to be devoured, but still just like being there and trusting that this might work, or trusting that she can give, instead of fighting it, giving it food, giving it what it needs at that moment. So the other poem that has helped me a lot in the past few years that I've been working with too is from Wang Wei, from the 7th century, is that right? 700s? Yeah. it's a short poem. In my middle years, I've grown fond of the way. I head out from my hut on South Mountain to look for sights only I can see. I follow the stream back to the source and sit and wait for the time when clouds arise. Perhaps I meet a woodsman. We talk and laugh, and I forget to go home. So reading this poem kind of reminded me a little bit of one of those Tibetan or Mahayana Lojong slogans. I don't know if you know about these. They're these kind of like little slogans that help you remember different practice. Remember to practice. And it's abandon any hope of fruition. So abandon any hope of results. What I liked about this poem is that he's going out to, you know, see the clouds, see these things, and then he gets lost and talks to a woodsman. I started to think about this poem as like, what is arising in my life right now, in my everyday mind right now? And for me, it's my classroom a lot of times. And I think it's very natural for teachers to want to try to control the situation or try to control the kids, to have these goals that you're reaching towards, which is all, I mean, we have to have management of the classroom. We have to have a safe classroom. We have to make sure that people are learning. But this has really helped me think about it in a different way. And instead of like jumping into the situation, step back and see what is arising in the classroom right now. are they settled and ready to do what we're doing? Do we need to take a movement break? Do we need to do some stretching? Do we maybe need to move to having you two work together and you work to, you know, like doing partners? Or maybe they need to do individual work. So instead of like jumping in and sort of like following that lesson plan that I made last night, realize, let's just throw that away and we'll just go with what we have right now, what's arising right now in the classroom. This also has to do with thoughts. There's a lot of thoughts that arise while teaching, from, oh, this is going really well, I'm so good, to, this is terrible. And sometimes it's like one after the other, you know, like in the same period. also, feelings, like I was saying earlier, about trying to control the situation so it will turn out well. And I think part of this goes with what I like about this poem is it really brings home this idea of the present moment. And my vision of my understanding of the present moment for a long time is that it's a perfect moment where everything works out, nothing goes wrong, if you do it the right way. You know, if you are mindful, nothing bad's going to happen to you. This is kind of where teaching has informed my Zazen practice, in that nothing ever goes as planned when you're teaching a bunch of fourth and fifth graders, you know? Like, it's like, that's just the nature of it. Like, and it's better when it doesn't go that way. But it took me a while to learn that, you know? This present moment isn't like this perfect moment where nothing goes wrong. It's actually where this everything is going on. And watching the clouds arise and then responding, like the other story, you know, that's kind of really what teaching is all about, responding in the moment to what's going on in front of you. So I learned from this poem really helped me think, well, watching clouds, you're not really watching, you can't control them, you just watch them and let them go, and observe them. And I realized that we do have to have safety, and there do has to be some sort of classroom management and organization, but why not have us as the whole class do this? So giving the kids some control, or giving the kids ownership of their learning, so that it's not just me trying to do it. And actually what happens is that when you give the kids ownership of their learning, they tend to rise to the occasion. When you give them choices, they tend to respond by, hey, that's what I want to do. And so they will follow that. And so they're much more engaged, they're much more willing to learn, and they tend to do a lot better, and they're just happier. A lot of what we have to do sometimes as teachers is you know, there's standardized tests that we have to prepare for. And I'm very lucky because I don't necessarily have this. Coming from the top, like all of your students must meet this and all of your students must have this. We have that a little bit, but it's a little bit looser than in some schools. So what I found, though, is that if you try to teach that way, you're going to lose the kids. You're going to lose them. They're not going to be engaged. They're not going to be interested in what you're learning. And so to give them that choice, to give them that freedom to do at least not everything they want to do, but in some way go in a direction of what they would like to do, has really made them more engaged. And so letting the control not come from me, but let it, like the clouds coming up, like you can't control that. And the other thing that I have, this is brought home to me, is this this idea in schools where, and parents come to us a lot with this too, like, so my son is in fourth grade, what's he going to be like in middle school? And then in middle school, what's he going to be in high school? And then in high school, they say, well, in college, they're going to do this, you know? And then in college, well, when you get in the workforce, you know? Like, and so this is constant, like, it's always the future, you know? Like, it's always like, so I'm very against this idea right now because I feel like it's always like this result that we're reaching for, that kind of like abandoning any hope of fruition. Like thinking, sometimes I like to think, I'm not thinking about you as a middle schooler or as a high schooler. I just want to look at you right now, and what do you need right now to do what you need to do? And this really helped with that student I was talking about, Asa, because thinking about him, what he did yesterday, like maybe he was choking someone yesterday on the playground, that didn't help to bring that into dealing with him today. Thinking about how he's so far away from his peers in reading. You know, he's reading at a second grade or first grade level, and his peers are at, you know, fifth grade, some of them at eighth grade level. That's not helpful to be thinking like that. Just to encounter him with what he needs right now was much more productive for both of us. I got off my script a little bit there, you know. that's better that way. The other thing I liked about this is the woodsman. And this is something that I kind of just started, when I was preparing for this talk, I was like, oh, I forgot about the woodsman. So perhaps I meet a woodsman, we talk and laugh, and I forget to go home. And this is really, I thought of it like, okay, so he's going out into the woods to have this great meditation experience. He could have said, I saw a woodsman, and I told him I needed to go meditate some more. Or I saw the woodsman, I met the woodsman, and I ignored him because I had to get home to make tea or whatever, you know. Like, it could have been like that. But instead, he talks and laughs, and it's almost like, This is everyday mind here. Like, this is what came up. The woodsman came up. Oh, so I'm going to treat this person in an authentic and natural way. We're going to laugh. We're going to talk. And, oh, I got lost. Okay, what's next? So there's no result here. He's not, like, getting home at the end of this poem, you know? I that was really endearing to me. And I know, like, this is kind of what happens. What I've been trying to bring into my teaching as well is things that don't have a result that I know ahead of time. So asking questions that I don't know the answer to are really wonderful, especially when you can. It takes some training for kids this young to get that. You have to like kind of model that for them. But once they get it, they come up with some really great questions of their own that you would never even think of. Or in science, we started. I There's a lot of focus right now on engineering and design. And so one thing that they say is like the best thing to do is to give them some things to build it, make mistakes, then do it, build it again, test it out, make mistakes, and just keep going through the cycle. And so for kids that are in my age range, I have this thing called mystery boxes where you put 10 items in different boxes. Usually it's from the recycling, like toilet paper tubes, that you know those little bags that oranges come in, like popsicle sticks, whatever, you know, like 10 objects. And then you give them a situation. And the one I like is Bigfoot is, people are coming across Bigfoot. They're going to find his secret hideout soon. So build something using these items that can help Bigfoot stay in his secret world. And when I first did this, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen with this. I have no idea. And some of the things they came up with were amazing. Like one of them was like a trap to come down and grab someone and build, you know, bring them away. One of them was like this, like secret, like it was like camouflage, and then Bigfoot could run away. And then it was like this, all these things, and it was like things, and there were things like egg cartons and you know like rubber bands and stuff like that. But they had this like really great experience of just working with these materials, and even more importantly, working with each other to come up with this. And so my job is to sort of like let that arise, and if I see something where someone needs help, then I'll help them. But usually it's with a question like, oh, we don't know what to do with this. It's like, I don't know, what can you do with it? You know, like just keep turning it around on them, like, or oh, Katie, what do you think you could do with it? You know, like, I mean, just like sort of like keep turning it around on them, and so that they start to realize, like, oh, we can figure this out on our own. And it's really like this, meeting this woodsman, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to pop up, but it's usually pretty interesting. It's usually it's usually pretty fun. And with that documentary project I was talking about earlier, we didn't know how this was. We had this great idea to make these documentaries. We had never made documentaries before. We hadn't like filmed anything before. And so it was really like the kids knew a lot about this, so they were making it. And then they, you know, we learned about together how to make these documentaries. And they turned out to be these really kind of neat things. I mean, they're not professional or anything, but they're really touching and moving. And we had no idea that this is what they were going to turn out to be. So even though we had this result we were going for, we had to stay in the moment of like, okay, what do we need to do right now so we can maybe get to there, you know. So I was really just like, I just love that phrase of like taking care of what's in front of us. It's like we just had to take care of what we needed to do today to make these things work. And sometimes that was writing scripts or writing, interviewing people or editing the films. I have two quotes that I'd like to read at the end. This is from Reb Anderson's book, Being Upright. And I had read this book when I did Jukai, and then I just happened to pick it up the other day. And I was like, wow, this is really good. Very, very appropriate. Like, it came up, like the woodsman. It's like two parts. When you begin to understand interdependence, you're grateful to everything that happens in your life, because everything that comes to you is Buddha Dharma, or Buddha's teaching. You turn toward the very situation where you feel pain and anxiety with the intention to understand it all more deeply, and you immerse yourself in the life of your present understanding. Understanding interdependence, you don't try to distance yourself from any manifestation of life. No matter how painful it is, no matter how deluded, you don't feel separate from it. You also don't run after it. You just deal with whatever comes up without trying to manipulate, negotiate, or finesse the situation. I thought that was a great description of how to work with everyday mind, ordinary mind, without this result, without trying to approach it with this idea that I'm going to catch it or I'm going to realize this. Just like turning toward what is happening right now, whatever manifestation is coming right now. And so that's my story, like my, you know, my everyday mind. And I also think there's like just a lot coming here like has really helped me work with a lot of the monsters that are going on right now in the world. I mean, we all have our personal things that we have to deal with, our own personal grief, sadness, things that we feel are shortcomings maybe. But then there's all these bigger monsters that are threatening and could destroy us. I mean, the climate change is one, of course. Racism and injustice in this country. There's so many things. Like, how do we respond to these? How can we relate to these monsters in a way? Is it as monsters? I don't know. Is it as clouds arising? I don't know. There's. I'm just like, I think these stories and poems really help me anyway figure out a way to deal with these. So, I don't know. That's my talk. I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts about this, about how you relate with either personal or bigger issues. Thank you.
Two things. One is I've heard that sometimes the teaching how to relate to your delusions, that to greet them but don't invite them in for tea.
Oh.
Just made me think of the story of you.
Yeah.
You know, the listener, but mm-hmm. She did invite the monster in.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a difference there.
She did it the wrong way then? Is that it? No, it's kidding. yeah, maybe that's...
Yeah. And then when we're talking about control and giving the kids in your class a chance to choose, the Suzuki-Roshi teaching of the... You want to control, you know, give your sheep a large mm-hmm. meadow.
Yeah, like the big. That's a quote I forgot to put in here, but that's one that I used a lot with the student. It's like giving him like a little bit bigger enclosure. He still tried to break that down and actually like kept going, you know, like but still like that movement there, like in the space, you know, like really. I mean. Even just physically, like being able to move a little bit more in the space was very helpful, yeah. Thanks. Oh.
I'm so jealous of those kids, I didn't have such a great I'm just wondering what your colleagues think of your teaching style or your whole school sort of.
It kind of ranges. So I teach my team, there's three teachers, and we kind of have a similar philosophy, and so we kind of teach that way. We kind of live in a bubble a little bit because we, you know, but I think there are other teachers in the school who teach the way I do. So it's sort of like, but not everybody. There are more, you know, there's some of the teachers who are more traditional, you know, doing worksheets at a desk, and I always think that it kind of has to be a thing, too, where you have to feel right about your style. Like, if you don't feel, then you're not going to be, you know, honest with the students. You're not going to be able to, you're going to be thinking about how much, you know, you don't want to teach this way. And I've seen that, too. So it's, I guess it's sort of, I think I can teach this in this way because there are other people that support me. And it's more of a team approach that we have. Yeah, they're doing just yeah. Yeah, they, yeah. They still leave learning how to read, and they still go to middle school afterwards. Thanks. Yes, sometimes it's because I don't know what to do with it either. But yeah, thanks.
Wonderful, wonderful talk. Thank you, Matt, very much.
Thanks.
So, let's close with our four bodhisattva vows, which are in your chapters.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.